You are listening to Cinema D'Amore, a podcast based out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We are moving into a new theme, which, if you can hear the cool sound effects I hopefully managed to add, our theme is snowed in. We're doing something different from our normal December routine of Christmas movies, which we've done, I think, pretty much every single year. Or at least, I mean, the year that we did Star Wars, we had a Christmas episode snuck in there. The whole month wasn't dedicated to Christmas, so I guess we've taken some time off before.
Yeah.
And hopefully, if you notice something, we don't sound like total shit right now.
Yeah, we figured out those problems. Ironed out those kinks.
We ironed out the kink of why does this sound like someone's running a vacuum cleaner through your episodes.
We figured it out.
Which is a great time to do a month to do two episodes, and two episodes only.
Yeah. Two random assorted episodes.
Right, so nothing sounds like shit.
It wasn't a whole month long.
I pride myself on this podcast continuously sounding better. And if you listen to the last episode, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and then listen to this episode, your mind is going to explode with how great the quality is. Really, these guys are leaps and bounds better than they were last week.
I mean, we were just trying to give you the sound of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles in that last episode.
We wanted it to sound like shit, so you know where we've come from.
Yeah.
Also, another reason why I'm always saying don't listen, not that you should not listen to our past episodes, but you never have to play catch up. You could just jump into whatever you like.
Yeah.
But everybody likes Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and everybody likes V for Vendetta Truck, so.
It's true.
These are favorites. These are going to be a dark mark on Cinema D'Amore for a while.
We'll just randomly re-record those ones next year.
Okay.
For the exact same dates.
We'll just take them down secretly since they're over, then nobody can listen to them, and then we'll throw them back up. People will be like, wait a minute.
We'll just gaslight everyone. We'll just be like, no, those episodes never sounded like that. What are you talking about?
Right. They've always sounded podcast like sleuth will be on Apple Podcasts and say, hey, the numbers, there's numbers missing. I figured it all out. They took it down. Which is something we don't do. If we sound awful, it goes up.
Yeah.
We have to learn from our mistakes, and that is life and podcasting. It's all the same. Snowed in. What exactly is snowed in? Basically, the theme that I was thinking of was winter, or something, I think mostly kind of heavy winter themes throughout most of them. Maybe not the third one as much as it just being taking place in winter.
Yeah.
But it's almost full on snowstorm for everything. And we did a good job at picking four movies, different genres, that all have that theme in it, which I'm pretty excited for.
Yeah. We kind of build up to literally the apocalypse of snow.
We do.
Spoiler alert, it's the day after tomorrow. I didn't want to have to give that away so early, but you know.
it very much could be the day after tomorrow.
It would fit our theme.
Well, I didn't think about it this way either, but usually the way that we'll set up things is chronologically. So we'll pick our movies and we'll just do what came out first. But we're time-wise, this is kind of working out in the same way where the setting takes place in the movie is also chronological. Because this is back around the end of the Civil War, and we're literally going into the future.
Yeah.
We hit present day a little bit-ish. Twice.
Yeah.
But our very first one is a spaghetti western, which is a genre that I love, and I've kind of wanted to go back to westerns for a while, so it's nice to have this one off, because this one has always been kind of unique to me. It would fit well with one of our very first ones, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, because they're both those like western, very cold, wintry-esque westerns, and this one just like, I don't know, there's something really fun about the 1960s, when all these spaghetti westerns took off. I mean, everybody knows Leone. He's obviously the number one international spaghetti western director, that hands down. And it took me a little bit longer to find Corbucci, which I think is probably number two. Is that ish? I mean, I don't really know. There's several that could fit underneath of him.
Yeah, there's a few other ones out there, but I feel like the quality of his is probably a little better than most of the other ones. a lot of the other like B ones that were out there.
He wanted to do this type of Western for a long time. Westerns were actually kind of the best thing that ever happened to Italian cinema, because they were able to mass produce like all these movies. Now, not all of them ended up being very good. And this is a director that's made some bad ones too. But pushing for that winter theme and how much time and money goes into that, because typically they were able to shoot these things right outside of Rome, so they could get into the desert fairly fast. And I think this is like the Dolomites, like up into the mountains of Italy. So it's not just that, it's all the problems that come with it, trying to work with horses in the winter. And I think that's why very quickly horses kind of fall out of the plot of this movie. But just that in general. And I know he really wanted to do this whenever he was doing Django. But Django, they said no to. And he's like, well, at least can we have a lot of mud? And they're like, all right, we'll let you do a lot of mud. And when that took off, that's where the success of this, or well, the opportunity of this came in. The success came later, because I think this is probably one of his best known Westerns of all time. Django's probably a little bit higher up on people's radar now with Tarantino's movie that came out.
Yeah.
But Corbucci's obviously a huge influence to Quentin Tarantino, who basically copied his Django and then immediately was like, I'm going to do the Snowbound Western next. We don't have any more Westerns, so we're not returning back to Hateful Eight. But this is clearly an inspiration for that movie.
Yeah.
Now, you watched this on Amazon?
Yeah. Yeah, that's... I don't know why. It was just one of those that it never popped up as easy to find as some of these other ones that I've watched. Obviously, I own all the Leone ones, and I own Django and a couple of the sequels, a few of the random odd ones there, and then I own like a bunch of box sets that have different ones. One of his has his other movie, Companeros, which is a very fun... It's more of a comedy with Franco Nero as like a Swedish guy. Who's like a Swedish bounty hunter. It's a weird one. But yeah, I don't know. I always wanted to watch this because I'd heard that it was really, really good. And it's usually if you read any lists of the best spaghetti Western films. Yeah, like you were saying, this and Django would kind of be the other two that were at the top, along with the rest of Sergio Leone's films. I thought it was good.
It stands out. Another possibility that we had was The Revenant, which is the most modern, probably, Western that I can think of. Django actually came out, or sorry, The Hateful Eight came out the exact same time. So they were pretty much neck and neck. Yeah, I'm trying to think of like, Jeremiah Johnson or something.
There's not a ton of Westerns that use, like, a wintry mountain setting. I think of... Now it's making me think of the beginning of Red Dead Redemption 2, because that whole part starts out in the mountains before you finally go back to the regular towns and country.
Which
area.
Is strange, because if you want to get into Red Dead Redemption games, they are both love letters to Westerns. The first is more of a love to the spaghetti Western, which is what this movie is. And then Red Dead Redemption 2, the prequel, is more of like a love letter to like the old school American Westerns, classic Hollywood Westerns, I would say.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was necessarily like original at the time, but there's a lot of spaghetti Western tropes in this, I think. Like the protagonist always has to have like some sort of crazy background that ties them into the plot that's going on. No matter how mysterious they are, they're going to bring us back there. And another wonderful thing is Italy took all these actors from all over these different places. And our lead actor is a French actor. And he was like, I don't know Italian. And they're like, don't worry about it, because
you don't need to.
You don't speak. Yeah. Your character is mute. Jean-Louis Trintignant, whose name I'm sure I butchered.
I was about to say, I couldn't figure out how to pronounce it, really.
He's mostly known, I guess, for like French romance films. So he's like, this was a very nice change. He said the character was a lot easier, but also it was very difficult because it was like all in the snow and all super cold and uncomfortable and kind of doing stunts. So that was like the con for picking up that type of character. But he does a really great job. And I mean, you have Klaus Kinski too, which is he's a wonderful bad guy. He's got his trademark terrible haircut.
Yeah, he's that's the interesting thing, I guess, with this one is, and I think you feel like this pops up a lot in these spaghetti westerns where they play up the villains to be a lot more interesting than in some of the, like, I guess, the standard American westerns where they're just kind of always generic bad guys. They got the Italians really love to add more of those shades of gray where even the good characters aren't necessarily really good. He still kills people, but he kind of does it for good reasons, I guess. He takes out bounty hunters. He hates them. And then you have Klaus Kinski that gets to play this, not even a ridiculous character, but he just has like this crazy look, which his name is Loco, which is what everyone calls him, but he does kind of have this like crazy look in his eyes every time they show him. He definitely enjoys just staring straight into the camera and getting those shots in.
Apparently Loco is not his name in the Italian version.
Yeah.
It's like how it's not even like a good translation into his name, but yeah, it's funny because that's another trope. What makes the villain instead of the hero, because the hero is not necessarily a good character either. They kind of are standing up for thieves. I mean, these people that he's standing up for basically ate the makeshift sheriff's horse.
Yeah, they're bandits. They're criminals. Yeah, they're not like necessarily good people. They're still criminals.
Right, but the bad people are the ones that love violence.
Yeah.
They're the people that just, they get an extra kick out of it. Yeah. And that's the thing that you've seen all these spaghetti westerns. The more cruel they can be, the more they eat it up, the more they enjoy it. And that's how you can usually differentiate between who's good and who's bad. Yeah. Because if you're looking at who these people are, you wouldn't think the bounty hunter would necessarily be the bad character.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of how many westerns out there that the bounty hunter's technically the good character, you know, he's seen as bringing them to justice. That's, that was Steve McQueen's first thing, Wanted Dead or Alive. He played a bounty hunter, and it was viewed as the hero bounty hunter that takes down the bandits that rob people and steal things. Like, he was the good guy. So it's interesting to take a movie where he's the bounty hunters are considered the bad people. To say that, like, a lot of spaghetti westerns like that, something even like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, where the character that's supposed to be the good isn't actually necessarily that good. He's doing some sort of con scheme with Tuco, and once he finally gets his use out of him, he just like, okay, I'm done with you, and like kicks him off in the middle of the desert and leaves him.
Yeah, I mean, this guy has this great introduction too. He's just coming through the snow, and there's a couple people on the hillside. They are bandits. I guess presumably you would obviously guess they're the antagonist to this character that we don't know. And they try to attack him, and he basically takes them all out very quickly. He probably has one of the coolest guns that I've seen in a Western, too.
The firearm in the film is a Mauser C-96, the Construction 96, which was actually manufactured from 1896 to 1937. And it is actually historically accurate in this film because the film takes place in 1899, during the Great Blizzard of 1899.
The gun itself is still pretty fucking cool, though. And you get a really good glimpse of it while he's target practicing with potatoes. And the sheriff, who's like a bumbling fucking idiot, comes up and they kind of have this like camaraderie for a few minutes. It's actually kind of nice because he hears the gunshots going off. He's concerned. He goes and checks it out. And it's our protagonist, also known as Silence. Also is a mute and doesn't talk. Perfect. And he has this gun that's a pistol that's a machine gun. And the thing that I find the coolest about it is it has this like little wooden carrying case box, which is also like an extension hilt that you can attach to the back of the gun.
Yeah.
He only does it like that one time, too.
Yeah, I was about to say, he only uses it in that target practice thing with the sheriff. He never actually uses it to fight any of the bandits or anything like that, which that definitely 100%, and that's another common thing with the spaghetti westerns And I don't know that I see it too much in like real Hollywood Westerns. And maybe that's just because Americans are more crazy about guns. So then they're also like, no, it has to be 100% authentic. But the Italians are like, I don't know, man, that just looks cool or something like that. Like the scene with Tuco, like taking the guns apart, and Eli Wallach's like, I didn't know what I was doing. They just told me to take guns apart and put them back together. And people are like, you couldn't actually do that. You couldn't just take them all apart and stick the pieces back together and just make your own gun.
Years ago, there was a thread on Twitter, and it's this guy that was just breaking down the inaccuracy of Westerns and movies, and there were just so many of them. Pretty much every single one, the hats are wrong. These are hats that didn't exist in the time. They just all look cooler.
Those look cool, yeah.
He's like, they didn't look really, they're not really anything to look at. They all pretty much look the same. You're more likely to see, like, the bowler hat, I guess, than, you know, like, the cool, you know, classic spaghetti Western types that you're seeing in this. Another thing that is the gun holsters were never at the hips. They were always up really high, like, around the chest. What you would see somebody wearing if they were a detective in a modern detective movie. That's kind of where the guns were holstered. But it doesn't look as cool when people are hovering over their guns to have a shootout with the antagonist of the movie.
Yeah, you gotta have that cool camera angle.
There's been other ones, too. I know they were making fun of Django with Tarantino's hat, which had, like, the zip-up string thing. Yeah. And they're like, those hats definitely didn't exist then.
That's where I feel like, Tarantino gets away with a lot of, like, just purely stylistic things. Like, I'm sure there's a lot of things in Django that you could completely pick apart. And I feel like that's what happened with this movie, is somebody working on it saw that gun and how it had that, like, holster on it, was like, that'd be cool to give, like, a character in our movie or something like that.
Initially, too, the reason I brought it up was, before I knew that it was a holster, well, hilt, the first thing I saw it as was the holster. And then he was making his way up towards these bandits, and he opens it up, and I'm thinking, we're used to the quick draw, so how's this helping you to have your gun in a wooden box? And then later, there's a moment where the sheriff, the newly appointed sheriff, gets attacked by all these bandits, too. And his gun doesn't work because he didn't take care of it. So I thought, oh, the box probably also doubles as something that's keeping his gun warm so that it works fine in the winter. And it just had one of those concepts that might be accurate, definitely feels accurate. But I can't think of another movie. Like, I've seen movies where, like, the guns are, like, in the snow and they have no problem working.
Yeah.
You know, or the guns fall in the water and they have no problem working. Like, they can shoot them under the water if they wanted to. There are no issues with that at all.
Yeah.
So that was, like, a wintry concept, too, that I liked. I liked the horse chugging along in the beginning with the snow that was, like, too high. And then when he fell over, I'm sure from actual exhaustion, and they're like, that's the last that you see of the horse.
Yeah.
They're like, we're not doing a bunch of horse shit in this.
Yeah, be too much. We'd have to dig him out of the snow every 10 minutes.
I know they had problems with the horses, and there was some behind the scenes footage that I thought was hilarious. They couldn't get a dolly shot because they couldn't build the dolly. So the shots of, like, somebody on a horseback, there's literally a cameraman on horseback right next to them being, like, led like a little kid with a pony, essentially, to get those shots. That and another trick that I never knew before. When they went back to shoot in the Western town, because they obviously didn't build the Western town up in the mountains for the movie, tons and tons of shaving cream.
Yeah, you can kind of tell in some of the more, like, where it's more close of seeing a character, like, fall in the snow or something. Like, I'm like, that's some weird fake snow they're using.
Yeah. Or, like, I've liked some of the behind-the-scenes stuff, too, where they're just, like, dumping blood all over them. They're like, here you go, and they're just, like, pouring blood on them. Yeah. I was like, yeah, they did seem extra bloody almost every chance they had. But, yeah, this is one of the movies, too, where, like, I love the style. I kind of like the quiet protagonist, because a lot of the stuff ends up being exposition mostly anyways, so it takes a lot of that out of the picture. And then I just, like, I love the whole idea of, like, the wintry setting. Like, I love the people, the other bounty hunters and stuff that are trying to stay warm in that little pub. and like Silence opens the door and all the snow is like blowing in on them. And they're like, will you close the goddamn door? Like, it just feels extremely natural, like more natural than, you know, that happens now.
It's the part where that guy's eating that chicken. It made me think of Denethor.
There's a scene where if you like, I don't know what the sexual desire is called, but if you like watching people eat things kind of in a gross way, obviously it wouldn't be gross to you because you sexualize it. But there's a guy that eats a whole chicken. I think you watch him eat the whole thing.
Yeah, he does like eat that entire chicken there. I don't even know. It's like, it's not even the eating, but it's in like a lot of those old, where they're showing like an older time period where they didn't use like silverware or napkins or anything. So he's like, he just has that grease from a full rotisserie chicken and he just starts wiping it on that fur coat. And I'm just like, oh, that fur coat's got to be so disgusting.
There's going to be a lot of fairly disgusting things back then, I think.
Yeah.
How do you feel about this movie overall? Obviously, as we get into it, it's one of the more darker stories, I would say, overall.
Yeah, I liked it. I don't know. We won't jump to the ending necessarily yet, but it was definitely a surprise. I didn't expect it, and kind of like really, I don't know, kind of, I guess, foreshadowed some stuff that you see in some other films that came out later, that this is like one of the first films that I could think of ending in that way. That was definitely a change of pace from Westerns. We can get to that a little bit later, but
well, I mean, the character that, like, I mean, you could take it back a little bit too. We learned that the character can't speak because as a kid, his throat was slashed, not to kill him, but to make sure that it cut his vocal cords or something.
I mean, it might have been to kill him, and he might have just accidentally survived.
Well, they literally say, is he going to talk? And they're like, he's never going to talk.
Well, yeah, he can't talk if he's dead.
Yeah, maybe he can't talk if he's dead, but convenient that he literally can't talk.
That's another, I guess, I feel like a very specific like spaghetti Western thing is, yeah, to have like people with odd deformities or something else weird that really makes them stand out or something different. Like Sergio Leone loves it too. I know it's what he said. He would go into like take care just to even hire extras for the background that had like really interesting faces because he just wanted them to look weird or not just like a standard like background actor. He'd get like people that had like some odd look to him, or it makes me think of
Eastwood's the same. Eastwood as a director is exactly the same. He tries to pick people that don't have that Hollywood look, but kind of have that
give him something interesting. Yeah. Or like something like when we talked about El Topo. That's another one where just like everyone in that movie has some sort of weird either deformity or something strange going on with him. Although the film gets a little more into straight up surrealism than anything else. So it's kind of expected that everyone in that movie looks kind of freakishly deformed or strange.
Which is why we covered it on our surreal
episodes. Yeah.
Yep.
That's another.
Because it probably fits closer to that, but it does have that idea of revenge. So these outlaws, I guess, they end up killing his parents and ultimately not killing him, which I think is a huge trope in so many Westerns. Like, I just watched The Harder They Fall. It is exactly the exact same thing. I don't know if you've seen that movie. It's on Netflix. It's worth checking out. Same concept. Kills the family, deforms the kid a little bit, lets the kid live, and the kid grows up to basically want to take revenge on the bad guy. I also kind of like that the idea, too, that obviously he's a very terrible person. The guy that ends up killing his parents and then in the modern times is, what was his official role? He's like the peacekeeper or something.
Yeah.
Seems to happen a lot where these extremely vicious people end up becoming more muddled as they become older. You always have this character that wants to enact revenge. And the person that they want revenge against is usually like a cobbler or something. Like they don't look like they would be much of a threat to anybody anymore. And for the most part, that's what that character seems like. Obviously, he's like still kind of running things in that town with when they finally show up and he has a guy follow him. Like, see where that guy's going. Keep track of him. I want eyes on that guy. This character is a full-on rapist, so he deserves to die.
And another good thing that they do in this film that feels like very specifically to Corbucci, he does it in Django too, is For whatever reason, again, we talk about like the deformities, like the main character shoots off people's thumbs so that they can't hold a gun properly anymore, which he does to the main, the peacekeeper character. We learn that he did that to that guy.
His hands literally get destroyed too.
Yeah. His hands get all jacked up. And then in this movie, the main character gets his hands stuck in like hot coals of a fire. So it burns his hand so that he can't hold a gun. And then he gets his hands shot later too. And it's like, I don't know why that is very, very specifically like Sergio Corbucci loves like destroying the hero's hands so that they can't use a gun anymore.
I mean, even King takes that in the Dark Tower series. Yeah, his first book is the Roland is like the best gunslinger there ever was. And then the beginning of the second movie or book, he gets fucked up by these lobstrosity things. So
he loses his hand
for the rest of the series. He's like, you know, he's a good shot, but he's not as good as he used to be because
he can only use his left hand because his right hand has he loses the fingers.
Right. And he's not as strong in that hand. And I feel like if it's not specifically this movie, it's a trope that's carried over into enough movies that it stands out as something that's like, you think about these spaghetti Westerns or Westerns in general, a huge theme is that this character is the most dangerous person because they are literally the fastest gun in the West. They're accurate. They're quick. Their hands are everything. So that's why their hands are always like being taken out.
Yeah.
Which it also kind of goes back into the whole idea of adapting the samurai films, because they were always looking for a way to like shame the samurais. So essentially like losing and then cutting off their bun or just anything that makes them less of a man. And in the Westerns that we're getting, especially the spaghetti Westerns where there's a lot more like scoundrel-esque characters and they don't necessarily have to be good people. They're always looking for a way to kind of take pride away from them in some fashion. So I think that's kind of where the mutilation comes from. Plus probably liking violence. It's probably a combination of the two of them. Do you like the name of the town?
Snow Hill.
Just Snow Hill.
They weren't going for too much. They didn't want to use too much creativity. We have a character that's mute. What do we call him? Silence.
What will we call this movie? The Great Silence.
Yeah. Like I said, I had a really good time with this movie. I think we've gotten far enough in. We can maybe talk about the ending, because this is one of those movies that's kind of, I don't want to say that's the best part of it. It is one of the best parts of it, though, that final scene.
It stands out. It's a bold ending.
It is really great.
We have a couple characters that you kind of have to bring into the end.
Yeah.
The bumbling sheriff character, he was taking this bounty hunter, had him captive, and we didn't really talk about his escape, but essentially Klaus Kinski gets one over on him, loco, because he has to take a shit, he says, and it's exactly where he hid a gun in the snow, which works.
That was a good plant and payoff there of showing the gun laying in the snow. All the way back at the beginning of the movie when they're picking up the bodies on the route to Snow Hill. And we see it sitting there and he like kind of pushes it under the snow a little bit.
He shoots the ice around the sheriff and like plunges to his death. You know, he goes back to get his bounty hunter buddies because he knows that all these bandits were welcomed back into the town to basically like feed themselves now because times are so bad. And that's where that is heading. And then on the other side of things, where we talked about the peacekeeper who was, you know, peacekeeper slash rapist slash gangster, they ended up killing this other character early on in the movie and widowing his wife, who became a love interest slash the person that hired the character Silence to assassinate Klaus Kinski's character, Loco. But, and you mentioned this already, Silence, he always wants to be in the defense. He never will just straight up assault somebody, so he'll never walk in and just shoot somebody. So one of the things that you'll come across is he tries to instigate people into pulling out their firearms so he can, you know, take them out. And there's a moment earlier in the movie where he has he's in the bar with Klaus, and he like lights his cigar and he throws the match inside his shot and he picks it out. He's like still gonna continue to drink it, and then the whole fucking cigar goes flying into it. And it's such a good move because Klaus is like, I know exactly who you are, I know exactly what you're about. And I'm not giving you the benefit. If you want to shoot me, you can shoot me right now, but you're not going to get what you want.
Yeah, that is a good scene. I do like I like when he just stands up and he holds his hand up and he tells one of his guys that's with him. He's like, you know what? You better just take my gun just to make sure I can't shoot him and no one can even say that I even started reaching for it.
Yeah, I do like that. Yeah, you take it off for me. You keep it. I think that's another cool methodical thing that really plays out fun tension wise but he also kills this other character and widows the wife, and the wife basically wants this guy's head. She basically puts a hit on him from a hitman that won't kill somebody unless they're defending themselves. So there's a lot of stuff, there's a lot going on right there, but that's kind of what the climax is building up to.
Yeah, getting into those moments there. That's when his hand gets burned. The big, I don't know, the big henchman of the
of henchman the number guy one
sticks his hand in the hot fire, which then Silence shoves his whole face into the fire and burns him. Mm-hmm. So I do love that shot. It feels like a Home Alone thing. It is 100% actually directly a scene out of Home Alone where he jumps through the window and sticks his face right in the snow to like cool his face off from getting burned. It's straight up the same as Joe Pesci running out with his head on fire.
His face is smoking. He jumps out through the window and shoves his head directly in the snow. It's
100%
shot from the Great Silence to the Great Home Alone.
So yeah, that's a fun moment there. And then, it just gets, super dark from there when Klaus Kinski rounds up all the bandits. You know, he wants to go back and take out Silence, which when he gets his buddies from that little shack that they're in or whatever, the other bounty hunters, and they don't want anything to do with him until he, provokes the one guy and says, oh, it's the guy that killed your brother, which I don't even know who his brother is. I assumed maybe it was the guy that ate the chicken or something, that was his brother or something like that, because he specifically references that he killed his brother.
It makes sense, and it also makes sense that it could be totally unrelated.
It could be someone else
anything
entirely
that we've
seen.
Yeah, it could be. He anybody. Basically throws math at him. He's like, there's 20 of them, and how many of us? We're all going to do good.
Yeah, they want to make their money. Klaus Kinski's character has been bringing up that he feels like he can make a lot of money in this little town, just rounding up bandits. But once they go back and they take out all the bandits and round them up to the saloon, then he kills the lead prostitute, maybe. I don't know what her exact title is. The woman that works in the
saloon.
She is
definitely,
there.
Yeah.
I guess that's who she's supposed to be. And she even tries to shoot at him and takes his hat off, and he does the same thing as Silence does, oh, you saw her, she shot at me first, now I'm gonna kill her. And then just continues from there. But I don't know, that I didn't this movie did not end the way I expected it to. I was wondering where it was gonna go. We see Silence put his gun for his left hand, which again feels like exactly like we were saying with the Dark Tower, his left hand's definitely not going to be his fast hand. So you're thinking, oh, is he going to have to do some sort of trick to beat Loco? Is he going to have to, throw something at him or do some other weird, trick to get one up on him? And nope, there's no trick, nothing
I mean,
that he can
you
do.
You can get into it a little bit. Up until that moment, where the big face-off is going to go down, they had went into the bar and they have essentially captured all the prisoners. They have them at their bay, and then you have Silence coming, who's essentially been a protector of these people throughout the whole movie. And I mean, that's kind of the climactic moment that you're building up towards in this movie. And it all goes to hell in a very spectacular way. Wonderful way, I think, which you can get into it if you want, because I know you were talking about it, but I'm setting up some other things because I know I'm kind of going to go over some of these alternate endings too that the film has.
Yeah. Yeah, it gets. I even feel like for like that this is even different for a spaghetti western or westerns in general. Even in most of the spaghetti westerns, it feels like a lot of the characters, even when the villain says something like, when he tells the girl to go back and tell Silence, it'll just be a battle between you and me. The other guys won't interfere or do anything. You know, it's just man against man, which is 100% a lie when he finally gets there. That even in most westerns, that's like a thing of nobody else interfere. This is just between me and this guy. And in this film, it's just like Loco's happy to just sit there and let the other guy shoot him from the window and get him when he's just standing there not looking.
Prime example of the difference between classic Hollywood Western and the spaghetti Western is that pride is kind of gone and people will fight dirty. There's not that, like, that respect doesn't exist. And we know that's the same thing in real life too, because how was Jesse James killed? You know, that's a prime example.
Yeah.
He was shot in the back of the head while he was fixing a picture frame. Like, that's how he was taken out, not in this crazy gunfight, not in an honorable way remotely. So this has that, like, element of the other guy, bounty hunter number two, basically a no-named character, probably. I doubt he even has a name.
Yeah, I don't think so.
He shoots him and shoots him in the hand again. And then you're just sort of like, how's he gonna get out of this? So it builds up the tension so nicely between the characters. I mean, he tries to draw his gun, yeah, but his hands are just so fucked up, and they shoot him and kill him, and his love interest runs to his side, and Loco shoots and kills her, and then they all decide to go in and shoot and kill every single fucking bandit that they have in that bar. And that is where this movie ends, on one of the most negative, downer endings of all time, probably. It has a weird title card that comes up and basically is like, this is why bounty hunters were condemned from this crazy mass shooting of because they could take these people dead or alive. Like, I think they say right before they shoot them, too, they're like, we can kill all of them. There's bounties on every single one of them. Hopefully they were accurate. It'd be fucking weird to be like, yeah, you killed one innocent person, so there's bounties on all of you guys now.
Yeah.
Now, there are two alternate endings, which I don't know if you were able to watch them. Could you see them? There's the happy ending, which is exactly what you would imagine. None of these alternate endings really worked for me. I definitely think that Corbucci got that's the ending that he wanted. Yeah. And I think that this ending worked the best. But there was a happy ending alternative where, out of fucking nowhere, the sheriff showed back up because, like, you never saw him die. Like, he was just, like, in the wall. Like, he comes out of nowhere and fucking shoots Loco. And I think he tosses Silence a gun, and they go in and they kill all the bad guys. And
they can forate him.
Yeah, that's exactly what they did. And they save everybody, and that's the ending. I think he even kisses the girl, maybe making it up in my head. But, like, I feel like it's just 100%, like, that's what it is.
Yeah.
And then there was an ambiguous ending. I don't know where it ever fit in. I think it would have been super disappointing because it just kind of ends. It's Silence building up to the shootout. I believe he gets shot in his hand, and it's like that tense moment of what's going to happen now. And then the fucking movie just says, like, the end. And I'm like, I don't know. I mean, of those three endings, I definitely hate the happy ending because I just don't like the idea of the sheriff coming up out of the blue and, like, just saving the day. It doesn't really fit his character. What fits his character is being a dumbass that gets taken advantage of and shot into a freezing ass lake. Like, that's where that character belongs. And the ambiguous ending, I guess, could have worked, but it just feels anticlimactic where everybody dies, essentially. It doesn't feel as anticlimactic. It feels bleak, and it definitely is a downer. Because you want to see Silence win. It's kind of weird that you don't see him win, but I think it really stands out, the fact that they keep it realistic, where it's like, nope, this fucking scoundrel shot his hands. That's his best attribute. Even with his machine gun pistol, he's done for. And he's not saving any of these people. And even the girl dies. Like, killing your expectations. At the end of the movie, it literally kills them. I just admire it.
Yeah, I enjoyed. I don't know if enjoyed the ending is the right way to say it, but
too late, you said it.
Yeah, it's yeah.
I can mix it out, but you already said you enjoyed it.
Yeah,
so
out of all those endings, yeah, I would say this is almost the one that makes the most sense. Like the other one, the sheriff coming back doesn't make any sense. It kind of makes,
especially because he reminds me of like that. We were talking about him on the James Bond ones, but sheriff from Bond movies, like that's the equivalent of the sheriff.
Yeah, it's that's where it feels like partially with that. I'm fine with the way that it ends. Like I said, it almost makes me, it reminds me of something like The Wild Bunch, which came out like 2 years later. Of, you know, that's a movie that was very much, I think, inspired. That was one of the first American Westerns to kind of take the lessons from the spaghetti Westerns and bring them back to America and kind of show these characters in a more realistic light of, you know, not all the guys that were cowboys were necessarily good guys. Some of them were pretty bad. And it also has that same feeling of it's a little more modern. I know it's not after the Civil War. It's more into the 20th century or the very early, like 1900s, where they're very much past their prime, to where cowboys are completely being, you know, eliminated. Like no one wants to see guys walking around with guns anymore. And that's another film where, you know, the film ends and all your protagonists are, you know, all just violently gunned down, and no one has a happy ending in that film.
Hey, I mean, it is the plot too of Red Dead Redemption too. Like that's what they go for. Going into modern times and not really needing the bounty hunter. If you think about it, though, Klaus, in the eyes of a lot of people, would probably be considered the good guy. Not in the lens of this movie, not in the protagonist's vision. But literally, if you heard it on the news, like, oh, yeah, this, you know, this bounty hunter went in and he killed all these thugs. That would be the equivalent of that.
Yeah.
You'd be like, oh yeah, he did a good job by getting rid of those people.
I feel like you're the modern day equivalent would be if you turn the news on, it was like, Dog the Bounty Hunter busted into this guy's house and shot 10 people.
He killed 20 meth heads. Like that's what it would be the equivalent of.
He went into the local projects and shot up the entire housing.
And then they bring in the question, should bounty hunters be able to kill people like this? And then it gets outlawed itself.
Yeah.
That's essentially what would happen. I need to watch more Kabuchi films for sure. There is a wonderful little documentary made for TV thing I was watching called Westerns Italian Style. And there's this great quote. I'm going to see if I can get it and put it on here.
Sergio Corbucci, you are directing your 7th Italian Western, The Great Silence. What do you think is the reason for the success of this type of film?
Success? The Westerns. The main reason, I believe, is that, we assume or recreate the atmosphere of our time, a time of violence. Violence without reason, and often just for the sake of violence. It's the same, I think, the main reason for the success of the films of James Bond.
In this film, Mr. Corbucci, have you much death and violence?
You probably know that I am a Roman, and at home, in some class, is presumed to be the skeleton of Nero, who is proving to be a good example for me. Yes, I am killing a lot of people. I have killed more people than Nero and Caligula. But each time, it's more difficult for me to find a new method of murder that could be used in each film. I have used revolvers and Winchesters. I have killed with dynamite, with gas, with fire, with... I cut many things. I have cut ears and made my characters eat their own ears. In this film, I cut thumbs. I don't make my actors eat them because they refuse. Unfortunately, I killed too many people. I would like to make a film like I did much earlier, like them I made when I was beginning. My people usually lived. When I wasn't making Westerns, I wouldn't shoot anybody.
Now, in this film, I notice that you're not recording any direct sound. How do you arrange this with your actors?
Speech usually in Westerns of minor importance because we use every nationality, French, Mexican, American. It is often better for the actors to count than to speak. For example, the Frenchman would say, un, deux, trois. The American says, one. That means yes, but it could mean anything. It's unimportant. That's why I hate Westerns.
After this, Mr. Corbucci, what films will you do?
A Western, naturally.
And I love that. But yeah, I definitely can see the appeal to this movie. It kind of wins me over for, it has that spaghetti Western style. It has all the tropes, but everything fits nicely. It's not on as grand of a scale as The Good, the Bad, the Ugly. I don't think anything has or ever will be again. I would be really fucking surprised.
Yeah.
But of its time, this is one of the really good ones. And this is something that I think it's a little harder to find film-wise, because I think the boutique Blu-ray people is like Film Movement or something that I bought this from, which is pretty obscure. But I'm sure, like you said, when everybody starts ranting and raving about it being one of their favorite spaghetti Westerns, they're like, we're holding onto the rights to this movie forever, because this is essentially our moneymaker. This is what we have going for us. But seek it out. Chuck said it's on Amazon for a couple bucks to rent. Ooh. And I think it's good. And honestly, I kind of like the idea of, like, I don't know why, but, you know, it gets colder outside, especially here in Pittsburgh. You're going to get into the temperatures that are very unbearable. And I just like the idea of watching these winter movies where they are snowbound and they essentially have to, like, stay warm, because you feel like you're kind of putting yourself in that same atmosphere where you know that it's, like, frigid outside and your warmth is right there. It transcends the experience somehow. Yeah. I'm a crazy person. That's how I feel.
Yeah.
The movie that we're doing next week, a very famous John Carpenter movie that we've never talked about on this podcast. We have talked about it before on the other podcast that I was a part of. It's been a while, and we can make it sound better and hopefully have a better conversation. I'm talking about The Thing, one of my favorite horror films of all time. And that's like another thing, what I'm talking about, like that transcending cinema bullshit that I'm ranting on about. Like, I've experienced that weird feeling of, and one of them was actually with Chuck a little over 10 years ago. There was that huge snowstorm in 2010. And when I took Chuck home, we had lost power and the roads were really bad. So where our houses were, we could walk down the railroad track together. And just that eerie silence and darkness of just being out in the snow, and all you could hear is like the creaking trees, and some of them fell over, and there was a transformer that exploded once. I don't know where, but the whole sky like lit up green. But just like that eeriness of when we got to my little neighborhood, there was no power, no lights, and in the cold snow that was like piling up, like, it just eerily made me think of the movie The Thing. And when you get to those eerie, snowy, like, silent moments out in the snow, that's what it reminds me of. It reminds me of horror movies like that, or The Shining, or something like in that, that mindset. Like, that's the imagery that comes to my mind. So, naturally, that's why we're going with the Thing next. And then we're going to get out of it, and the movie after that's kind of more like what we actually live through, I guess. Well, at least the third movie will be more of what we live through. And the last movie will be like what we're going to live through.
Yeah, one day.
That's the big tease. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm Justin, by the way. I know I didn't introduce myself at the beginning. You can follow me on Twitter at JJMorgan19. Chuck?
ChuckFinn66.
Cinema Demore. You can follow us there at Cinema Demore on Twitter, /CinemaDemore on Facebook. You know, on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. That's where wherever you listen to us, please subscribe to us. That helps us out a ton. And if you could rate and review us, that would be really helpful too. You're not going to hurt our feelings. Actually, you might hurt our feelings, but we'll deal with it. But until next week, hopefully you're enjoying this theme. Stay warm. Good night.